Next to welcome Carlo Cepolano, and he will be talking to us about Einstein's equivalence principle and atomic clocks.
So can I take off the mask? So thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Philip, for introducing me. I'm very happy to be here to talk about these results because I actually worked on them during my master's thesis that I did here at PI, but online, unfortunately, due to COVID. So I'm very happy to be in person here to talk about them. So I will talk about a test for a quantum generalization of the Einstein equivalence principle. And this test will involve atomic clock interferometers. So I will also give a quantum sensing analysis of these atomic clock interferometers. The talk will be based on two papers that are in collaboration with Flaminia Giacomini and Matteo Paris from University of Milan. And I will start the first part of the talk talking about the test of this principle that calls Einstein's equivalence principle for quantum reference frames. So first of all, why is it interesting to study a test for this principle? Well, the Einstein equivalence principle is a cornerstone of general relativity. It provided the guidance and the intuition on how to build the theory. So one might hope that if one understands better how to understand and how to expand the principle to the quantum realm, one might gain some intuition on a theory of quantum gravity. So there have been many different proposals on what is the interplay between the equivalence principle and quantum theory. And so, for example, this is a very non-exhaustive list, but from 73 Aronov to this year. And these proposals are do not agree on what is the role of the principle. So some say that the principle is not valid in quantum theory. Some say that quantum theory can be used to test the principle. Some say that the principle should be modified to account for quantum phenomena. But how this should be done is not, there is no general consensus on this. So what I will talk about today is a test for the principle introduced by Giacomini and Bruckner in 2021, and I will call it the Einstein equivalence principle for quantum reference frames instead of the old title, which is way longer. And I would argue that, of course, in the presence of these very different ideas, it is fundamental to test these ideas and understand which one is correct. So I want to start from scratch, namely, on what the Einstein's equivalence principle is. There are many different definitions. I will report one, the one given in gravitation, which is any and every local inertial frame, anywhere and any time in the universe, all the non-gravitational laws of physics must take on their familiar non-relativistic form. So what this principle is telling is that locally there are no effects of gravitation. And this principle is always explained with the beautiful thought experiment by Einstein of the elevator near the Earth or the planet. And if the elevator is small enough, then locally the goose there will experience no gravitation. So there are three different aspects of this principle. There is the weak equivalence principle. There is local Lorentz invariance and local position invariance. The weak equivalence principle states that the local effects of motion in a curved space-time, namely gravitation, are indistinguishable from those of an accelerated observer in flat space-time. Now, this is, of course, a modern reformulation of the principle. This principle was known by Galilei in the 17th century. But what's telling is that the effect of constant gravitational fields are indistinguishable from the effect of constant acceleration. The other two parts are local Lorentz invariant that basically states the validity locally of special relativity, and local position invariance that states that the outcome of any local non-gravitational experiment is independent of where and when in the universe is performed. So if one wants to test the principle of course, one has to test all the aspects of the principle. So talking about the classical tests, well, the test for the weak equivalent principle is well known. You just have to compare the different acceleration of different bodies that have different mass or structure or composition. And if they're the same, then the principle is respected. If they're not, the principle is violated. Regarding local Lorentz invariance, one must test special relativity. So for example, there is the Michelson-Morley experiment in which they were looking for the existence of the ether. And it is possible to show that to test last part, one has to perform a gravitational redshift experiment, which was one of the first experiments that Einstein himself proposed. So I will review it briefly because it will be important next. So in this gravitational redshift experiment, there are two clocks that are put at two different heights in a gravitational field. And due to gravitational time dilation, the two clocks will peak at different rates. And one can compare the times and we'll discover that they're related to this gravitational redshift factor, which is just the difference in potential over C squared. Now, if one wants to extend the principle to quantum superposition, one question that might come natural is what happens when I just, for example, have one clock that is in quantum superposition between two different heights. And of course, it's not clear a priori how the time of this clock will behave, because at the two heights, there will be two different gravitational time dilation. So one way to address this question would be to transform to the rest frame of the clock and try to understand how the time peaks there. But if the clock is in quantum superposition, we cannot transform with a classical transformation. We have to use a quantum transformation. And so we have to use quantum reference frame. So quantum reference frames are reference frames that are associated to quantum particles that can be delocalized. I will be very brief on this because I'm sure you know it, but for example, on the left, from the point of view of system C, there are two systems, A and B, and A is well localized in the sense you can imagine that A is classical in the sense, and B is spread. And one can transform easily to the point of view of A with just a simple translation and a parity swap. Now, what happens in this more complex case in which the position of A is not localized? Can we still describe the point of view of A? And the answer that they gave in this article by Giacomini, Sorwitz, and Bruckner was yes, we can still describe the point of view of A by doing a superposition of translation. And the effect is that we can still describe its point of view, and in its point of view, it will be C and B to be in a superposition, and in this case, entangled. So we can use this concept to try to understand how the time of the clock peaks. So let's say, for example, that there is a mass in superposition of different locations, and this mass will exert a gravitational field. Now, how does a clock evolve in this space-time? Well, it will get entangled with the gravitational field, and so it's not clear what happens to the time of the clock. What they proposed in the article in which they defined the new principle was that it was possible to make a transformation, which is a quantum reference frame transformation, to what they call the quantum local inertia frame of the clock. The quantum local inertia frame of the clock is a frame that is associated with the clock in which the metric is locally flat and well-defined, in the sense that there is no superposition locally. So this is an extension of the local inertia frame of general relativity to quantum superposition. And of course, as one extends the concept of local inertia frame, can also extend the concept of the principle. So they propose this new principle, which states that in any and every quantum local inertia frame, anywhere and anytime in the universe, all the non-gravitational laws of physics must take on their familiar non-relativistic form. So what this principle is telling is precisely that in the situation that I was describing before with the masses in superposition and the gravitational field in superposition, one can transform to the reference frame of the clock and there is no effect of gravitation locally. The first thing that we did was defining the three aspects of this new principle that are just the generalization of the previous aspects to quantum reference frames. So, for example, regarding the quantum weak equivalence principle, the local effects of quantum motion in a superposition of uniform gravitational fields are indistinguishable from those of an observer in flat space time that undergoes a quantum superposition of accelerations. So not only a constant acceleration is indistinguishable from a constant gravitational field, but this is true also for quantum superpositions. And this principle was actually introduced for the first time in the first article about quantum reference frames. So what we found here is a link between a more general principle, which is this Einstein equivalence principle for quantum reference frames, to the first quantum weak equivalence principle. I will try to focus on quantum local position invariants to build some intuition examples. So I read it. It states that the outcome of any local non-gravitational experiment is independent of the position of the quantum reference frame in which it is performed. So let's say that we want to test this principle. Well, we know that to test local position invariants, one has to test universality of gravitational redshift. So if we want to test this new version, we have to test some new version of our quantum universality of gravitational redshift, whatever it means. So to define what it means precisely, let's imagine that there are two clocks that are at the same height. Then we know that we'll see no time dilation. So the gravitational redshift factor will be zero. But then what happens if these two clocks are in quantum superposition such that in each branch they are at the same height? Well, what we expect intuitively is that since in each branch they are at the same height, there will be no time dilation in this scenario as well. But of course, one has to prove it. And to prove it, the question that one must address is, what is the time of the second clock according to the first one? And to define and study the time that is seen by the first clock, one has to use quantum reference frames. So the formalism that we use is called space-time quantum reference frame. It was introduced by Comini in 2021. I will not go into the details of the formalism because it is a bit cumbersome, but I will just give a general overview. So this formalism is used to describe the quantum reference frame of some particle that evolve in a gravitational field that is generated by another particle. And these particles are not interacting between each other because their mass is small. So they're just evolving in the field of the big particle, which is the Earth in this case. And they have both external and internal degrees of freedom. So the external degrees of freedom are like the position and the momentum of these particles, while the internal degrees of freedom are used as clocks. So it is exactly as an atomic clock in which one can use the internal degrees of freedom to tell the time. So in this framework, the external degrees of freedom are used to fix the reference frame, while the internal ones are used to as clocks, as in the Page and Wouter mechanism. So what we did was identifying the laboratory frame with the frame of the mass that generates the field, with the reason that the laboratory is very massive. So it can be identified with the Earth since they are co-moving. So this formalism is used to describe the quantum local inertia frame of a particle. And it can also be used to change reference frame. So start from a state from the point of view of a particle and to obtain the equivalent from the point of view of another particle. So what I represented here is on the left, there is the mass. Sorry, I will take. No, thank you. I don't think. What is the stick? Ooh, oh, no, I want it. Definitely want it.
It's more for the novelty.
Okay. So on the left, as you can see, there is the Earth, and we are describing the point of view of the Earth. So near the location of the Earth, the metric is locally flat. And for example, it's describing a clock that is in superposition between two different locations. And the clock is in a curved space-time because it's generated by the Earth. Now, we can transform to the point of view of the clock in the sense that I was describing before. So there is a quantum local inertial frame associated to the clock. And in that frame, the metric is locally flat. And it is actually the Earth to be in superposition and in a curved space-time. So I will try to avoid all the technicalities as much as possible, but I just wanted to say that I wanted to describe what the state from the point of view of one particle is, and in particular, one finds that the state. So, in this framework, there is a physical state that obeys some constraints, and these constraints are the one that describes the dynamic of the particle. And for each particle, there is a metric, and one can show that if you make a certain transformation, which is just, let's say, a transformation that maps to the relative coordinates to the particle and then projects to fix the position of the particle to zero, to fix the origin of the reference frame to zero. One can show that if you do this operation, the metric associated to that particle will be flat at the position zero.
Like the curvature would be on zero, it would be
inconsistent
at this point.
Okay,
so yeah. If you make what you call flat,
yeah.
It becomes 1, 1, 1 minus one.
Exactly. Indeed, yes. So what you obtain is that from the point of view of one of the particles, you obtain a history state in the sense of the Page-Wooter mechanism. So you obtain a superposition at different times of the state at time t times the state of the internal clock at time t. So if you want to obtain the time evolution, you have to project on the state of the clock. And this is exactly the role of the clock in this table. So what do you obtain? In the laboratory frame, you obtain this Hamiltonian, which is just the Newtonian Hamiltonian, if you are using the Newtonian potential, plus an extra term. And that extra term describes the clock. So that HI is the Hamiltonian of the clock. And it is multiplied by some factors. And these factors are the ones that encode gravitational time dilation and special relativistic time dilation. And the reason is that, for example, let's say that that Hamiltonian is a two-level Hamiltonian, just to repetition. Then one can use it to tell the time by measuring the frequency of the photon that is emitted in the transition between the excited state and the ground state. And of course, due to those terms, the frequency will be modified. And it will be modified exactly by the redshift factor that we wrote before, and the other factor that is responsible for special relativistic time dilation. Now, interestingly, this Hamiltonian that we found in the laboratory frame is exactly the same Hamiltonian that it was used by Zick et al. And by Zick and Bruckner. And this Hamiltonian was actually used to define a quantum formulation of another equivalence principle. So what we found here is that there is a link between the two principles, because we start from this principle that is true for every quantum reference frame. And what we find here is that if you just look at the laboratory, which is, again, the source of the gravitational field in this context, then you find the previous principle. Also, I wanted to add that the same Hamiltonian can be found, and this is actually the work of 2011, by taking just the Newtonian Hamiltonian and performing the substitution from the mass parameter to the operator mass written there. With the idea that if one believes in the mass energy equivalence, one has to, or at least can, account for the internal energy in the mass. So if one accounts for the internal energy in the mass and then recognize that the internal energy is actually quantized, one obtains actually a mass operator. And with this operation, we find the same Hamiltonian that, that we need. So using this framework, I was saying that we can describe this quantum superposition of time derivation. But of course, we can also describe the classical UGR. So I wanted to start with this example in which, as I was saying before, there are two clocks at two different heights. And these clocks have the external degrees of freedom, that x plus and x minus, that are at different heights, and the internal ones. The internal ones, I was saying, are just the clock, so the time, and we start from initial time zero. So what we can do is to transform to the point of view of one of the clocks. And what we find is that we can study the time of the other clock. And here we find exactly the gravitational redshift factor that we expected. So this is a way to say that one can study classical UGR with this framework. But of course, the real power of the framework is studying the situation that I was describing before of quantum superposition. So let's study this state in which it is an entangled state. And it is an entangled state between the two clocks being at the location up, superposed with the two clocks being at the location down. So I was saying that intuitively we would expect no time dilation in this setting, but without quantum reference frames, we couldn't know how to answer this question. And what we find is that we can perform a quantum reference frame transformation and describe the point of view of one of the two clocks. And in this point of view, the time of the second clock is not dilated. There is no factor there. So it means that using this formalism, we can find that there is no time dilation. Maybe an even more interesting example is this one, in which the clocks are still entangled, but this time there is one clock up, the other down, and this is superposed with vice versa. So in each branch, we expect to find a gravitational redshift factor. But of course, a priori, we don't know what is the answer if there is a superposition. And the answer is this one. So for each branch, there is a time dilation factor. And the time dilation factors are one with the plus sign and the other one with the minus sign. And again, this is exactly what we would expect. Because from the point of view of A, the first time B is down and the second time B is up. So there is a redshift factor for each possible position of particle B as seen from particle A. So all these examples are just to say that it seems that using these entangled clocks in this state, we can tell something about quantum UGR. And if we can tell something about quantum UGR, it means that we can tell something about quantum local position invariance. So this suggests that these clocks can provide a test for quantum local position invariance. But of course, this is not enough. In order to test the principle, what we should do is introduce a model for violations and verify that the model for violations is correct, so that it actually model violation of the principle, and then find an experimental setting in which the outcome probabilities are sensitive to this violation. And this is exactly what we did. So we started from this mass operator that I was talking about before, and following the example of Zick and Bruckner, what we did was considering three different types of mass. So there is the inertial mass, which is coupled to the momentum. There is the gravitational mass, which is coupled to the gravitational field. And then there is the rest mass, which is uncoupled. Now, since, for example, let's say that we want to model a violation of local Lorentz invariants. Local Lorentz invariants in the quantum sense was saying that the outcome of experiments is independent on the velocity of the reference frame. So what we did to use the most general violation that we could come up with was introducing an explicit dependence on the velocity of the frame in the mass. So what does it mean in this context that quantum weak equivalence principle is violated? It means that the inertial mass is different from the gravitational mass in this operator sense. And same things for the other. So we can define some violation operators that are eta, beta, and alpha. And so if eta is zero, it means that the weak equivalence principle is true. If beta is zero, local Lorentz invariance is true. Alpha is zero, local position invariance. And what we did was studying a setup in which the outcome probabilities were actually dependent on these parameters. So what we found was that, let's say that we impose that only local position invariance is violated, for simplicity. And in this case, we found that we cannot transform to the quantum local inertia frame of a particle anymore. Now, what we mean by this is that I was showing you before that the point of view of one particle is represented through a history state. And here we find that we cannot write the time evolution from the point of view of a particle anymore. And the reason is that this is not simply a time state because there is a dependence on the position. And it's actually very good in the sense that this is what we could expect because if quantum local position invariance is violated, it means that the outcome of experiment should depend on the position in which they're performed. And this is exactly what we find. So we find an explicit position dependence that shouldn't be there. So this tells us that the model that we chose actually represents what we want. Now, since the laboratory is very massive, we showed that it is still possible to describe the point of view of the laboratory. So it is still possible to find an inertial frame for the laboratory, even if it's not possible for the other particles. And so this allows us to make predictions from the point of view of the laboratory. Because of course, if you cannot describe the point of view of the laboratory, it also means that you cannot make predictions, and then you cannot say anything about the experiment. So I wrote here the Hamiltonian for a violation for quantum local position invariance only, just for simplicity. And so as you can see, the Hamiltonian is very similar to the one that we had before, with the difference that the internal Hamiltonians are different. So there are two different Hamiltonians. One is the gravitational one, the other one is the rest one. And since they are different, in principle, there is some experiment that could measure this difference from the standard Hamiltonian. And of course, a natural choice for this experiment are atomic clock interferometers, because what we were describing before is a quantum superposition of different atomic clocks. And this is exactly what is done in an atomic clock interferometer. So what we did was starting from the state that I was describing before of these angle clocks and letting it evolve in an atomic clock interferometer with the Hamiltonian that I wrote 1 second ago and perform a Bell measurement. And what we found are some probabilities. And these probabilities are pretty ugly, but they do depend with some function on the evaluation parameters. So this means that the probabilities are sensitive to violations of the principle. And this is true both for local position invariants, local Lorentz invariants in this quantum sense. And in order to test quantum weak equivalence principle, we don't actually need to test the full eta operator as a with all the diagonal elements. But since there is a relationship between the different operators, we just need to test actually just the classical one. And we actually showed that it depends on the classical one. So this means that these entangled clocks can, in this atomic clock interferometer, can provide a test of the principle. So, as a take-home message for this part, we introduce a model for violations of the Einstein equivalence principle for quantum reference frames. Then we showed that these entangled atomic clocks can be used to test the principle. And then we also found a link between different proposals of this quantum, of different quantum equivalence principles. So this is a good moment for a break.
So you wrote down eta as a function of alpha, beta, and classifier. So these three were three different quantities that indicate whether one of the three sub-efforts are required. Why one of them cannot one other?
You can write any of them as a function of the others. And the reason is that the three aspects of the principle written in this way are not independent. So there is a relationship between them, and there is also a conjecture that is a Schiff's conjecture that says that actually this principle, from assuming just the two of them, you can always find the third one.
I'm very glad to lose that question, but how does something like this, like, can you expect this principle to hold with like full interpretation of the quantum?
Yeah, I think so, in the sense that this is just standard quantum mechanics and it doesn't rely on any particular interpretation. So,
right. I guess I was thinking with the superposition of the Earth, the Earth is like a very, especially a very classical object. Like, I imagine someone's like, oh, what are you meant to do with the quantum state if you have a classical condition?
Well, of course, you can believe that you cannot put a very massive object in superposition, but this is not standard quantum mechanics. It's more than an interpretation.
Right, right. I guess like with many worlds, with like if you just allow like a quantum imprint, you have, I guess your wave function is like some environment and the product itself, that environment and the product itself. And if your environment, I guess like if we do experiments, we condition on the environment and introduce the quantum state that's collapsed. And I guess, yeah, I guess I wanted to. So I guess you could say that you shouldn't be able to do this with the like. So if I did some experiment and I had like, I presume I'm going to see the see some classical object and then conditional things, and then I'd get a different one to say depending on. So like the tensor product spin up, superposition spin up, spin down. Presumably, like that's okay, but then the spin down or like spin middle. Tensor product that I don't see position of left, right. Some interpretations presumably I would say that that's be treated as like two separate branches because the Earth is like in many worlds, some version of many worlds because the Earth is in classical condition. But I guess the same would be this would be excluded from the principle form.
Yeah, I would say so, yes. For the reason I was saying.
Right, right.
So.
field or even not in a gravitational field.
spreading of the wave back. So this is a range.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I think that argument holds when you stick to the original equivalence principle and you try to apply it to quantum mechanics. And of course, you will find that it is not true because there are some other features that are the quantum mechanical features, like the expansion of the wave function. But this is not what we are doing here. Here we are talking about another principle, which is a new one. So in this sense, new physics in the sense of merging different different theories. Okay, so I talked about atomic clock interferometers, and now I would like to give quantum sensing analysis of these tools. So the question that we try to answer is it possible, even in principle, to use joint effects of gravitational time dilation or general relativity in general and quantum theory to improve the precision of your measurement? And the answer that we gave is yes. So I will go very briefly through classical and quantum estimation theory. So the idea of these theories is that one wants to maximize the information that you can gain from some sample, from some data. So given a sample space and given a parameter of interest, lambda, there is this bound that's called Kramer-Rao bound that tells you that the variance of this parameter that you're interested in must be greater or equal of 1 over m, which is the number of measurements, times the Fisher information. So there is this quantity that is the Fisher information that tells you how much information is contained in your sample, namely on your probabilities. So if the Fisher information is big, it means that your variance of the parameter can be as low as you want. So it means that you have a lot of information. If the Fisher information is low, it means that you are not using the right parameter, the right sample to obtain your parameter. There is a quantum equivalent, which is the quantum Fisher information and a quantum Kramer-Rao bound. And the difference is that the quantum Fisher information is always greater or equal to the Fisher information. So you have two things that you want to maximize here. You want to maximize the quantum Fisher information, and this means finding the best state and the best Hamiltonian to know something about your parameter of interest. And when you did that, you want to find the best measurement to extract the information. And how to find the best measurement? Well, it is the measurement that maximizes the Fisher information. So these are two, in principle, different aspects, but of course they're related through that relation. So what we did was studying this atomic clock in a freely falling interferometer. So the results that we were talking about before were general. We didn't give any particular shape to our interferometer. Here we are studying a freely falling one. And in this interferometer, there is an atomic clock, and the atomic clock is modeled with a Gaussian wave packet for the external degrees of freedom, and with a two-level Hamiltonian for the internal one. The clock enters inside the interferometer after a beam splitter, and there is a phase shifter of phase phi. And we begin with the initial state, say zero. So there is this superposition of the two trajectories. And then there is an initial state for the clock, which is just a balanced superposition of the two states of the clock. And then after the evolution, there is another beam splitter, and then the two outcome ports. The interferometer are measured. So to model this atomic clock, we use again the same Hamiltonian that was in the point of view of the laboratory. And we actually had a linear approximation of the potential for simplicity. And now we ask the question, how much information in this setup can we find about the gravitational acceleration g? And what we find is that the quantum Fisher information, which again is the maximal information that you can find in a setup, scales as the interferometric time to the sixth. And this is an interesting result because previous results say that if you do not have gravitational time dilation, so with the standard Hamiltonian, what you can gain is just time to the fourth scaling. So this suggests that if you actually use not only an atom, but an atomic clock, so also gravitational time dilation in this context, what you gain is a better time scale. So this says that gravitational time dilation in principle may be used to make better measurement because you have more information in your state. Now, of course, the question is, if you have more information on the state, what should you do to extract it? So can you actually make some probabilities that give you this information or not? And the answer is yes, but you have to be smart. So the standard measurement in which you just measure the outcome port of the interferometer and you ignore the internal degrees of freedom will give you official information that scales as time to the second. So it means that ignoring the internal degrees of freedom make you lose some information. So if you want to exploit all the information there is, you have to measure both external and internal degrees of freedom. We also studied a similar scenario. This time it's a Mach Zehnder. So it means that the trajectories are horizontal. And if the trajectories are horizontal, it means that we have to balance the gravitational attraction with some external potential. So if it wasn't a clock, if it was just an atom, then this term will be zero because there will be no internal Hamiltonian at the time. And so the particle will be just a free particle evolving. And of course, in a free particle evolving, there is no information about any gravitational quantity. So from this, we can already imagine that the presence of gravitational time dilation will give us some information about the gravitational fields that will be absent without gravitational time dilation. Here, for simplicity, we did a piecewise linear approximation of the potential. So the potential is linear in every trajectory. So in the upper trajectory, there is a G plus, and in the lower trajectory, there is a G minus. And here we are interested in studying the difference in this gravitational acceleration and in the mean value. And of course, as I was saying before, we expect that the quantum Fisher information for a state without the gravitational time dilation would be exactly zero, because there is no information on the gravitational field if there is no gravitational time dilation. And we find that if there is gravitational time dilation, then we find this time scaling as time to the second. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it depends on what you're interested in. Here we were interested in measuring either G plus or G minus or delta G or average value of G.
Okay, it's not with delta G.
Yes. So the importance here of the time is that you find that the information that is contained in a state depends on the time, but you're interested in other quantities. So the information on other quantities depend on time. And if here there is no clock, so this term is zero, you see that, of course, it doesn't depend on G anymore. So you expect the information to be zero, even for infinite time. And what we find is that there is an actual dependence. So it means that the presence of gravitational time dilation, even if you keep still these trajectories, make your experiment sensitive to G plus, G minus, delta G, average value of G. And now the scaling is far worse than what we had before in the free falling. And again, it is intuitive because you're losing some information if you, about the field if you keep them at the same height. But the good news here is that just a simple measurement of the external degrees of freedom, also ignoring the internal degrees of freedom, will not erase the information. So it is optimal to extract the information anyway. So to conclude, we show that gravitational time dilation may be used in a step to enhance your quantum measurement about some gravitational parameters. And that to exploit all the advantage, you should measure both the external and the internal degrees of freedom. And with this, I thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Gavin. You're joining the talk, but we have more questions also. If you have questions on the online, raise your hand.
Yeah, I might have misunderstood something. So in the set to measure the gravitational redshift where we sent one up and then sent it back down, you said there is like a delta T squared or delta tau squared improvement when we consider the internal degrees of freedom. The internal degrees of freedom, those are like the time component. And so I'm wondering, like, in what setup, like in the classical, in the other setup that you're referring that has a delta T to the power 4, why would you not measure time in that setup? Like,
so the point is that if you have a quantum degree of freedom that measures time or not. So here you can take just a standard atomic interferometer and have some atoms that evolve in interferometer and measure G.
Okay.
And then you can ask yourself how much information I have about G. And the answer you get is it scales as time to the fourth. Okay. Now, if it's not just an atom, but there's also internal degrees of freedom that act as a clock, so it evolves in time. Okay. Due to gravitational time dilation, you gain more information. And so it scales as the time to the sixth.
Okay,
Thank you.
Thank you.